I guess, is there any question about the subject they've covered so far? Or the problems, or the lecture? Is everything 100% clear? 50%? OK. That's good. So after these last two lectures, we are all now professionals at taking the large end limit of anything and being able to organize the expansion in terms of fishnet diagrams that you can draw on higher and higher genus Riemann surfaces. And the main message that we saw from this beautiful analysis was that the large N expansion of Gauge theories is structurally exactly the same as the world sheet expansion of perturbative string theory. And I even gave some kind of dictionary that this large N expansion generates for you that relates the parameters of the large N expansion of the field theory to the parameters of perturbative string theory. But as I said in the lecture, this doesn't really give you a tool to reconstruct directly what the dual string theory is. So in order to really do that, we need some new inputs. And in this lecture, what we will do is we will put forward a proposal for the string theory dual for a very special class of large N field theories, which will be theories that are conformal invariant or conformal field theories. Okay? And this will lead us to the famous ADS-CFT correspondence, which hopefully today I'll state for the case of n equals 4, which I'll tell you what that means in a second. And this is something that this has been a huge advance in the field, as I tried to explain in the first lecture. And this was crystallized by Maldacena in 1997. Exactly, when this paper appeared, I was pretty much in your position. I was also a beginning student. And already back then, it was absolutely amazing, the paper. And I hope that in the next couple of years, you also will find a paper like that that will, after 10 years from it, we'll still be talking about it. It's really a remarkable thing. And I hope I convey some of the ideas of it. So in order to be able to make something like this, the route that we're going to take is not just to study any large N quantum field theory, but study special ones that have as much symmetry as possible. Because if you have a quantum field theory, the more symmetry you have, the more constrained the theory is, and the more we can do to solve it. So what we're going to do is study more symmetric quantum field theories. So I use the word quantum field theory and gauge theory interchangeably. For this lecture, they mean exactly the same. Conventional quantum field theories, at least relativistic, quantum field theories are invariant under the Poincaré group, which is generated by translations and Lorentz transformations. Okay? And these are the basic space-time symmetries of relativistic quantum field theories. You might try to relax this to non-relativistic field theories. So instead of getting Poincaré group, you get what's called the Galileo group. And in fact, there is, in the last few years, there has been a beautiful development of extending the ADS-CFT correspondence from the relativistic setting, where you have a field theory that has a large N expansion, to a non-relativistic setting, where you have a non-relativistic field theory being dual to some string theory. So one very basic question about quantum field theory would be, can you find a bigger set of space-time symmetries under which a quantum field theory can be invariant? And actually, there are a whole bunch of what are called no-go theorems These are just the statements that under certain assumptions, you can prove what is the most general property that the theory can have. And constraints, given those assumptions, what are the allowed space-time symmetries that the theory can have? And so we're not going to go over the details of these Nogos theorems and how they're proven, but an obvious symmetry, now we're talking about space-time symmetries, an obvious space-time symmetry that you might want to impose in a field theory would be a scaling symmetry. Where you would demand, which is generated by the dilatation operator, which you've been working a lot during the exercises, you would require the theory to be invariant under scale transformations, which is just a rescaling of the coordinates. Okay. So first of all, can a theory be invariant under this? Obviously, the answer is yes. But a necessary requirement for a theory to be invariant under a scale transformation. Notice that here I'm scaling coordinates, and therefore I'm also scaling energies. So a theory can only be scale invariant, and therefore have a scaling symmetry, if the theory does not have an intrinsic dimensionful parameter. If the theory has an intrinsic dimensionful parameter, there is no way it can be scale symmetric, because the dimensionful parameter will change under a scale transformation. Okay. So this requires the existence of no dimensionful parameters in the field, in the theory, like masses, like dimensionful coupling constants, and so on. This is not completely true. Let me tell you a little caveat, because you can start with a theory that has a mass parameter that corresponds to a relevant operator. So these are operators that become important in the infrared. Is this language familiar to you? Okay. So you can have a theory here which is non-conformal, non-scale invariant, but that under a renormalization group flow flows to a theory that is scale invariant. Okay. But right now we're going to be talking about theories that are defined in the ultraviolet. So this will be a flow from the ultraviolet to the infrared. We want to study theories that in the ultraviolet have manifest scaling symmetry. Okay. So how do we characterize more practically when a field theory is scale invariant? So one way of doing it is to do the following. So remember that a scale transformation is just a particular coordinate transformation, and coordinate transformations change the metric of your spacetime. So the first thing that we can ask is, what happens to a quantum field theory if I make a change of a metric? So you have a quantum field theory that's living in some spacetime with metric GMN, and now it changes the metric by doing a coordinate transformation. Then the variation of the action due to a variation of the metric gives you precisely the stress tensor times the variation of the metric, where this object is the stress energy tensor. And this is the object in field theory that measures the response of the theory to changing the spacetime, changing the metric of spacetime. Okay? So we're going to characterize scale invariant and conformal field theories in terms of properties of the stress tensor, stress energy tensor. Okay? So now imagine we do a scale transformation under a scale transformation. Can someone tell me how the metric changes? So imagine I do scale transformation. What is the change of the metric? Excuse me? Yeah, so but infinitesimally, I'm doing infinitesimal transformation, what you would get is 2 delta lambda GMN. So just rescales the metric, essentially, by a constant factor. So invariance, and this is the dilatation operator, invariance under D Invariance means the variation of the action vanishes, right? You have a symmetry if the action is invariant under the transformation generated by that transformation. So this will be, delta S will be zero if the stress tensor is traceless, okay? So a field theory is scale invariant if the stress energy tensor is traceless, because then under the scale transformation, the variation vanishes, okay? So this is a very nice characterization of scale invariant in quantum field theory. But now actually, if you have a scale symmetry, you have more symmetry, because if the theory is scale invariant, the theory is also invariant, not only under rescalings of the metric by a constant parameter, but also invariant under arbitrary rescalings of the metric, where h is a function of x. And remember that this is essentially the definition of a conformal transformation. And the reason is the same as this, as here. If I make a conformal transformation, and the stress tensor is traceless, which we already said it's traceless if the theory is scale invariant, then it's automatically invariant under conformal transformation because the variation vanishes, okay? So that means that the theory is actually invariant not only under the scale transformations, but under conformal transformations. So now what we've done is, if a theory has this property, we've gone from a theory that's invariant under Poincaré. To a theory that's invariant under a bigger space-time symmetry, which is the conformal group, which I think by now you know how to deal with pretty well. So how do you find what are the generators of the conformal group? Essentially, what you have to do is solve this equation. And remember that under a change of coordinates, So where xm goes to xm, infinitesimal change of coordinates, times zeta epsilon. Then you know that the metric changes essentially by the Lie derivative, which in terms of the covariant derivative can be written like that. So the theory is going to be, so the conformal transformations are ones that satisfy this equation, which is nothing other than this equation. Now, this h of x I can solve for in terms of this parameter of the transformation by taking the trace. If I take the trace, I can solve h of x in terms of the covariant derivative. And then this equation is just exactly the same as 2 divided by the, okay, so this d is not this, okay, maybe I should write z hat. This is an operator. This is the spin-time dimension. So you get this times the covariant derivative of epsilon, okay? And this is called the conformal. So if this guy was zero, what would this equation be called? Oh, what does this equation generate for you? Sorry? Yeah, so if this was zero, you would get the Killing vector equation that tells you the symmetries, the transformations that keep the metric invariant. So what would those be for Minkowski space? Excuse me? And translation. So you will get the Poincaré group, essentially. This more general equation is called the conformal Killing equation. That tells you that the metric is not quite invariant. It transforms and essentially you rescale it, okay? And now you can solve this equation, and you can do this in any curved manifold, but for most of the lectures, we're going to care about flat space. So if you solve it in flat space, or Euclidean or Lorentzian, I change it in Euclidean and Lorentzian quite freely, you would get exactly the generators that you were working with yesterday. So you'll get the translations, the Lorentz transformations, the dilatations, and the special conformal transformations. These are all the solutions of the conformal Killing equations. You can write vector fields, which I wrote in the lectures yesterday, that solve this equation. Okay? And if you count the number of generators, so this guy, if we're in D space-time dimensions, there are D translations, there are D times D minus 1 over 2 Lorentz transformations, there is one dilatation, and there are D special conformal transformations. So if you add them up, you get 1 over D plus 1 times D plus 2 transformations. Okay? So these are the conserved charges of the quantum field theory associated to conformal transformations. So now you might ask, so we know from quantum field theory that any continuous symmetry has associated to it a conserved current. So you might ask, how do I write the conserved currents associated to conformal transformations? And you might not be surprised to find out that the basic quantity that generates conformal transformations has to do with the stress tensor. So you start with the stress tensor of the theory, which remember that you obtain by varying the action with respect to the metric. Okay? And then the conserved current associated to any of these generators, so current is a four vector, you will write it in terms of the stress tensor by saying that you have Tmn, the stress tensor, times precisely the Killing vector that I wrote yesterday associated to any of these transformations. So you would contract the stress tensor with the Killing vector. Okay? So this is the current, and this epsilon, I don't want to put too many indices, but this epsilon is an index A. I should put an A here also, where A runs from 1 to the total number of generators. This cannot be written. Okay? So now let's see under what conditions. If you have a symmetry, the current has to be conserved, which means that the covariant derivative of the current has to vanish. But now let's plug this in here. You have two pieces. When the covariant derivative acts on the stress tensor, and when the covariant derivative acts on the conformal Killing vector. And this has to vanish. So now let's choose at A's, namely, at particular transformations that are isometries, namely the Poincaré generators. Then in that case, epsilon satisfies the conformal, the Killing vector equation, which means that this term vanishes because the stress tensor is symmetric under the exchange of M and N. So I can write this as 1/2 of this guy plus the same thing, but N and M reversed. But this is precisely the Killing vector equation. So it tells you that in order for this to vanish, the stress tensor has to be divergent free. If this is an isometry, if it's a conformal symmetry, namely any of these other guys, so this would be isometry, this would be conformal, then, let's see. So now this right-hand side does not vanish anymore, but it's proportional to the metric, essentially. So what you find is that in order for the theory to be conformal, we recover exactly the same thing that we had before. This implies that the trace of the stress tensor has to vanish. Okay? Very good. So now we understand how in a quantum field theory we can generate how to write down the conserved currents associated to conformal symmetries in terms of the stress tensor and the Killing vector, conformal Killing vectors. And the stress tensor you just write down by varying the action with respect to the metric. So let me ask you a question. So here, I know you've heard from the string theory course that special conformal transformations can be generated by combining an inversion, a translation, and doing an inversion again. So can anyone tell me what the conserved current associated to inversions? Remember, inversion is a transformation that maps XM to that. I guess I'm writing M, I think. So what's the nether charge associated to this transformation? It's a tricky question, but it's a good question. Yes?
So what is the reference
associated? Precisely. So there is no conserved charge. I mean, you get a conserved current only for continuous symmetries. So the only conserved currents that you have in a conformal invariant theory are these ones, even though you could have discrete symmetries. Look at this guy, the discrete symmetry, because it squares to itself. If you do it twice, you get back the identity transformation. So now, the last thing I want to say about this, because it will be important when we connect to ADS. And this I'll leave maybe as an exercise, but I'll kind of tell you how to do it. So you are all professionals at the Poincaré algebra. You might wonder whether this combination of generators forms an interesting algebra. And what I want you to kind of see is that if we defined, so remember that I said here that we have such many generators. So I want to define now a new generator, let's call it M capital AB, where A will run from 1 to the dimension of space-time, but we'll have two more indices, d plus 1 and d plus 2. So now I have to tell you how the various components of this generator relate to this one. So if A is M or N, OK, how the pressure write this? So I'm just decomposing this in blocks. You have a d by d block, and then you have column blocks for this guy and this guy. So for this central block, what you get here are the Lorentz transformations or rotations. For the component, let me write it like this. So M, the component M, M, N, let me call it J in order to distinguish the two. So we have the G, M, N, J, M, N is the Lorentz transformations. Then we have that M, M plus 1 is a combination of translations and special conformal transformations. The component M, M plus 2 is 1/2 the other linear combination. And then finally, the M1, M plus 1, M plus 2 component is the dilatation, okay? So all that I've done is to compose this big matrix that has D plus 2, it's a D plus 2 times D plus 2, in fact, antisymmetric matrix. I break it into blocks, one that goes from 1 to D, then you have the column labeled by D plus 1, and then you have the column labeled by D plus 2, okay? And I'm just writing down, relating the various entries of this generator. I'm writing it in terms of the conformal generators. The reason I'm going through this is that now you can show, using the commutation relations that the conformal algebra satisfies, that you could obtain from the killing vectors I gave you yesterday, for example, you can show that GAB generates and if we are in Lorentzian, in Euclidean space, so we start in quantum field theory in d-dimensional Euclidean space, what you would get is the group SO1 d plus 1. If you were in Lorentzian signature, you would get SO2, D. The SO2, D algebra. Are people familiar what this thing means? Should I spell out more carefully what that actually means? Yes? Okay. Excuse me?
When you write Jm plus 1, do you mean Jm d plus 1?
Oh, yeah, sorry. Exactly. So all these guys are. Thank you. Yes. Again, this hopefully it's clear what the corresponds to what. Now the point is, well, you all know what the, well, hopefully you all know what the algebra generated by rotations is. So this is a straightforward generalization of that. So what you do is you take the commutator, and again, you can give a representation of all these generators in terms of the Killing vectors, because we know the Killing vectors of all of the conformal Killing vectors for these generators. So therefore, we know it for all of them, and then you just start doing the commutator. So eta is the metric that you would put, flat metric that you would put in Euclidean or Lorentz space. So I write it eta, but if you're in Euclidean space, it would just be the Kronecker delta. So what you get is eta AC G BD plus the same thing where now I marry this guy with this guy, G AC. And now I have to impose the fact that these generators are actually antisymmetric under A and B. So I have to antisymmetrize the right-hand side and the left-hand side under exchange of AB and CD. But that's easy to do. I just copy this column, exchanging A with B. And this is, by definition, the SO one of these guys. So depending on the choice of eta that you've taken, whether, okay, maybe more explicit. So if eta, the metric, maybe a little bit, is just 1 plus 1s everywhere, then you would get, as I said here, actually, so if you had, let me say more generally, so if you had a diagonal matrix with p plus signs and q minus signs. Of course, p plus q equals d. This defines for you the SO p comma q algebra. Recall now that if you look at Lorentz transformations or rotations, this is exactly what you get. If you look at the generators of Lorentz transformations, this is exactly the algebra that they satisfy. So what we're seeing now is that the conformal group is actually the same if you package it, generates the following symmetry. It's an orthogonal symmetry with this dimension. Any questions about that? So we see that by studying conformal field theories, we've gone from Poincaré to SO. So just for simplicity, let me choose one. Yes. So here we have many more symmetries. And that's going to be very useful to us in order to arrive at a potential large n dual. Okay? So now let's think of what class of theories, how we would construct theories that are conformal invariant. Okay. So I already said, since in order for the theory to be conformal invariant, in particular, it has to be invariant under scale transformations. And I said that that can only happen, modulo this issue of the infrared fixed point, if the theory has no dimensionful parameters. So let's look at a few theories just to get an intuition of how we can cook up. So well, there's a trivial way of getting a conformal invariant theory, which is if you look at a free theory that has no interaction, but that's, I declare, boring. Something more interesting, so let's look at the Young-Mills theories. So in which dimension, okay, so. So in which dimension is the coupling constant of Young-Mills dimensionless?
Four.
So at least classically, now we're talking about classically conformal invariant theories. We'll see that there are strong caveats. You can have a symmetry that's classically there, but not there in the quantum theory. And in fact, conformal symmetry is almost always broken by quantum effects. But this guy is classically scale invariant at d equals 4. What about a phi cube theory? So if you have a theory that has a g phi cube interaction, in what dimension is this scale invariant? No? I mean, it's good that to do this exercise because you have to, in physics, you can learn a lot just by doing dimensional analysis. So let's just do a little bit of dimensional analysis. What's the dimension of a scalar field in D dimensions? No. Sorry. I mean, this is not like bingo. I mean, why? Why is it?
So I would imagine, like, the value of a scalar field. Well, no. It wouldn't be a density, right? It would just, like, a scalar field. The dimension of the electromagnetic field is just, newtons per, it's whatever the unit.
No, so
the dimension of the magnetic field is, like, Tesla, right? So it doesn't scale with.
We're always working h bar equals c equals 1. Let's see what I mean by that. So remember, a scale transformation is something that rescales coordinates by lambda. Okay, let me write the action. Okay. So the action is what? It's d dx. Okay, so I didn't want to do this detour, but I think it will be useful, maybe. We have phi to the cube. This is the Lagrangian of our universe. Okay? So how do I determine the dimension of D? The way you do it is this guy has to be dimensionless, right? So let's count the dimensions, the length dimensions of this object. So you have D here. So you have, if I make a scale transformation, this guy will scale like lambda to the d. So I'm picking up the powers of lambda to the power, and I want to put this to zero. Okay, so you get d. The derivative is downstairs, so and I have two derivatives. So you get d minus 2 plus the dimension of a field. We count it in terms of the mass dimension. Okay, I have two fields here, so I have 2 minus the dimension. This has to vanish. That's the statement that this guy is dimensionless. The action, when h bar equals all blah, 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 1, it has to be dimensionless. So that means that the dimension of a scalar field in d dimensions, you always read the dimension of a field by looking at the quadratic part of the action. So that tells you that the dimension is d minus 2 over 2. So you were close, but not quite there. So now we want to determine in what dimension is lambda dimensionless. So how would you do that? Yes. So if this guy is dimensionless, let's find the dimension of this object, okay? So this guy has dimension D. By caveat, okay, so let's find the mass dimension, okay? So this guy, I already said that a single field has this dimension, so I have to multiply 3 times this. Sorry, d minus 2 over 2. And this has to equal d, so that it cancels this guy, okay? So that tells you that d equals x. So you have 3d minus 2d is d equals 3 times 2 equals 6. So if you want to study phi cube theory is classically scale invariant in 6 dimensions. You probably already know, but if you do the same exercise, you will find that lambda phi to the 4 theory would be classically scale invariant in 4 dimensions. Okay? It's important that you become familiar with this because many times when you are thinking about a problem, you can at least get an intuition of where things are going just by dimensional analysis. Sorry?
Theory homework to show finite dimensions.
Oh dear.
Sure, it was
I remember that.
So you're telling me I shouldn't have done that? Okay, I feel guilty.
It's like I played months ago.
Okay. Okay, so now exercise. A little bit more challenging. Find the critical dimension, which means the dimension for which the coupling constant will be dimensionless for the following interaction. The four Fermi interaction. I will ask you tomorrow for the answer. It's very simple. Just do the same thing, but take into account that this is a fermion, and fermions have first-order kinetic terms as opposed to second-order kinetic terms. But I think you'll be, I think it's a good exercise for you to figure out in what dimension this guy is marginal. So here is a coupling, and I want you to find in what dimension this coupling is dimensionless. Okay. I think that's probably sufficient. Is that sufficient, or should I elaborate more? Probably not. Okay, but so this is only at the classical level. Unfortunately, or fortunately, well, fortunately for nature, most theories break conformal symmetry quantum mechanically by quantum effects. And that's a statement of the renormalization group in quantum field theory. So even though this theory is classically dimensional, this coupling is classically dimensionless, we know that quantum effects of the type I was drawing in the first few lectures generally tell you that the beta function, which is the logarithmic derivative of the coupling with respect to some energy scale, is different from zero. And this generates a mass scale. So the theory is no longer conformal invariant. In fact, I'm not going to prove it here, but you can prove using word identities of field theory that the stress, I keep changing between mu and n, but I mean, that's a minor thing, but okay, let's try to be consistent. You can show that the expectation value of the stress tensor in any quantum field theory is always proportional to the beta function of the theory, okay? So the theory cannot be possibly be conformal invariant if the theory has couplings whose beta function run is non-zero, okay? So now we have to construct theories. The question is, how can we construct theories? This will have to be special theories for which, so we want to find theories for which the beta function vanishes, okay? Or they're conformal, that's the statement. These theories are very interesting for real physics, not just for crazy string theories in low dimension, because conformal field theories, since these are theories that have no intrinsic scale, these conformal field theories describe second order phase transitions, which I know you've learned I forget his name, Kadanoff. So these are phase transitions on which the correlation, there are correlations at all scales, okay? This, for example, happens if you study the Ising model, the two-dimensional Ising model, or the three-dimensional, but let's not be fancy, near the critical temperature. So you remember the phase diagram of the Ising model, you have a temperature, and there is a critical temperature. Below the critical temperature, you are in the ordered phase, where all spins like to be aligned. And in the disordered phase, the spins, they're disordered. Everyone does whatever the hell you want. And near here, you have a phase transition, which is described by a conformal field theory. Because the correlation length between spins grows arbitrarily large. with distance. So if you take two spins in the lattice, it grows, and you compute the correlation of a spin at site A and at site B. Near the critical point, it goes like a power law, like the distance between A and B to some critical exponent. Okay. So in conformal field theories, one of the basic physical features of conformal field theories is that correlation functions are power-like. They go, things fall off incredibly slowly, only power law. Usually, if you have a massive theory, things fall off exponentially, like in the Yukawa theory. But if you have a conformal theory, it just falls off power law. And in fact, this is a consequence of the word identities of the theory. And in fact, one of the tutorials today is to show that if you compute the two-point function of observables in a conformal field theory, of local observables in a conformal field theory, that their two-point function, or that their two-point function has power law behavior as a function of the distance between the two operators. So these theories are very interesting, and they are applied for real physical systems in the real world. And we're interested in higher dimensions. And there are many, many, many low-dimensional conformal field theories. There's a whole subject of two-dimensional conformal field theory that encapsulates minimal models and applications to all kinds of physical systems. Unfortunately, I don't have time to go into that. But it's kind of a big and important subject by itself. In higher dimensions, imagine I'm studying Young-Mills theories. I want to make the beta function equal zero. One way I can try to succeed at that is, again, by applying the same philosophy that I was using before, is by making the theory more symmetric. So originally, I went from Poincaré to conformal. Now we will go from, we will add to the mix supersymmetry, OK? So obviously, I cannot give a course on supersymmetry, even though that would be interesting to do. But essentially, what this does is add to the usual, what does supersymmetry first of all do? The first thing it does is relate the various coupling constants in the theory. So it unifies couplings, various different couplings that in principle they would be different if the theory had not this symmetry. And it pairs up bosonic with fermionic degrees of freedom. Okay. And again, there is one of these no-go theorems. Yes.
So which coupling does it unify?
Yes. So I'll tell you an example of that. A unify is not the right word. It relate. So let me. Okay. Since you asked, let me give an example. So now let me finish maybe the thought I had. But I forgot about it. Okay. Let me give you the example. So the example is, imagine you study a Yukawa theory with a self, so you have Yukawa. So you have, okay, fermions that couple to a field phi. And you have the Yukawa coupling here. Let me not use lambda, G Yukawa. And then you can have a quartic self-interaction like phi to the fourth, OK? Supersymmetry, and this would have its own coupling, G phi, OK? Supersymmetry, what it tells you is that the coupling constant of this interaction is actually related to the coupling constant of this interaction. It tells you that G of y is in a very precise function, which in fact is this depends on normalization. But essentially, this guy is the square of this guy, essentially. And the reason this is important for this problem, remember that the beta function has to do with the short distance properties of the theory that you have to regulate the theory. You have a theory where various couplings are related, you might have cancellations of the behavior of the theory in the ultraviolet. So let me give you an example. If you study Yukawa theory and you look at the propagator of phi, the two diagrams that would contribute would be this diagram plus a fermionic loop, OK? This guy will be proportional to G phi, right? And this guy will be proportional to G Yukawa, G Yukawa. Both diagrams by themselves are quadratically divergent. Is that obvious? In four dimensions, okay? But remember that fermion loops always contribute with a minus sign compared to bosonic loops, okay? So you might get a cancellation precisely if G phi is proportional to G y squared, because then the short distance properties of this diagram are exactly the same as the short distance properties of this diagram, but since they contribute different signs, you tame the theory in the ultraviolet, okay? So that's the basic thing that supersymmetry does for you. Improves dramatically the short distance behavior of the theory, and that, with appropriate choice of matter content and so on, you can then get a theory that has absolutely no divergences. Yes?
And do we impose this in order to have cancellations, or it's a result of supersymmetry?
So supersymmetry will automatically give you this relation. And now I'm trying to motivate it by going backwards. Why would anyone want to introduce supersymmetry? One would be this. The more important one is that, okay, that's what I wanted to say, that that supersymmetry is known to be the most general space-time symmetry that quantum field theory can possibly have, given some blah, blah, blah assumptions that are technical. But essentially, the most symmetric theory that you can ever have is a supersymmetric theory. And we like symmetries because when we have symmetries, we are better at solving things than when we don't have symmetries. Okay, so any questions about this? So the point now is that we're going to construct supersymmetric theories such that the beta function will vanish. And there are, you can construct millions of them. But we'll start with, the most symmetric theory that you can ever have, the most symmetric gauge theory that you can write down in four dimensions. And that's n equals 4 supertriangles, okay? So given this logic, you can ask, well, how supersymmetric can I make something? And it turns out that the maximal amount of supersymmetry that you can have in four dimensions is called n equals 4. Maybe I'll, at some point, I'll explain what this language means, but for the time being, let me just kind of do a very bottom-up approach and just write down the Lagrange and stuff like that. So n equals 4 supertriangles, which is the maximally symmetric gauge theory you can ever write down that does not contain gravity. By gauge theory, it means explicitly that propagates fields with spin at most 1. Okay. What's the Lagrangian of this beast? It's a mess, but I have to write it once and get it out of the system. Exactly, it's a very beautiful thing. Okay, it's not a mess, but okay. So G square is the coupling constant of the theory. So since it's a gauge theory, it obviously must have the kinetic terms for the gauge fields. This theory has matter fields that transform in the same way that the gauge fields transform, which means that they transform in the joint representation. In a less fancy language, it means that they're also given by n matrix. Remember that the gauge field is given by n matrix. So what we do is we have the gauge field. We add 6 scalars, where I goes from 1 to 6. And these are also n by n matrices. But we need, in supersymmetry, you always pair up in order to have these cancellations. Bosonic loops with fermionic loops, so we'll have to add fermions. Lambdas. I'll be cavalier. Okay, let me not put spinor indices. Maybe later I'll do that. So you have spinors. But unlike the usual spinors that you probably study in QCD, which transform in the fundamental representation of the group, these also are given by n by n Hermitian matrices. So these guys, if I make explicit the gauge indices, the n by n matrices, as opposed to the quarks, remember that the quarks only had a row index, okay? And the reason that all these guys have to be n by n matrices is a consequence of supersymmetry, because under supersymmetry, you relate these various fields, and they better all transform in the same way. It wouldn't make any sense that a field that transforms in different ways, you cannot relate them to each other, essentially. So the Lagrangian will have a kinetic terms for the six scalars. It has a potential term. It's kind of a Higgs potential. But since these are n by n matrices, it takes this form. It's a commutator square potential. You're going to have kinetic terms for the fermions. These are 16-component fermions. So these are the gamma matrices. And then you have a Yukawa coupling. OK, I want to be careful of normalization to be 1/2, 1/2, lambda bar, gamma I. And then you have a Yukawa coupling. But since this is, these are matrices now, you have this commutator piece here. And in four dimensions, what other term can I add to a four-dimensional Lagrangian for a gauge field that is consistent with everything, with a scaling symmetry and superconformal symmetry? Can anyone tell me? Excuse me? No, no. So right now I'm just writing down terms in the Lagrangian that are invariant under Poincaré symmetry and scale symmetry. You haven't seen another term that you can add to Young-Mills?
Ghosts.
Sorry?
Ghosts.
You can, well, you can. You have to add ghosts, but no, that's not what I'm talking about. Okay, so you can construct a dimension for another combination of F squared, which is Lorentz invariant. And you know this actually from electromagnetism. Because in electromagnetism, you have two Lorentz invariants, right? You have E squared minus V squared. What's the other one? No? Electromagnetism, come on. It's E dot B. OK? And in fancy Lorentz, using the gauge field, I mean, this is E dot B is essentially F. OK, if you want to write it in terms of components, let me get the normalization, right? It's 32 pi squared epsilon M N P Q. This is the usual Lebesgue-Witte tensor, antisymmetric, totally antisymmetric tensor. And then you construct F M N F P Q. Now you should go home and check that this guy is F mu nu, F mu nu, and this guy is epsilon mu nu lambda rho, F mu nu, F lambda rho. And these guys are obviously Lorentz invariant because there is no indices floating around. So this is the most general, well, this is n equals 4 Young-Mills, OK? And this guy, you might worry, why haven't I seen this? So can anyone tell me? OK, you will know this. But one reason you haven't seen this is that this guy has no effect whatsoever in perturbation theory. Because it turns out that this guy is a total derivative. You can try to check it. So it cannot possibly have any effect in perturbation theory because a total derivative has no effect in the Feynman rules. But it has important effects non-perturbatively. So there are non-perturbative contributions to field theory that are very sensitive to this theta angle, okay? And these are the instantons. So this is the Lagrangian of n equals 4. Notice that as I advertise, there is only one coupling constant, even though I have the coupling, I have the gauge coupling, I have a potential. This would be like a Higgs potential, but the coupling of the Higgs potential is exactly given by G squared. I have a Yukawa coupling, 2 lambdas 1 phi. It's also fixed in terms of G squared. So this smells like a supersymmetric theory. Now, in order to check it, it's a non-trivial exercise, which I'm too nice not to make you do. But I think, well, if you're really ambitious, you should really try to do it. The statement that the theory is really supersymmetric is a statement that this Lagrangian is invariant under the following continuous symmetry. So supersymmetry means, by the way, so this Lagrangian should be, in order to really quantize a gauge theory, you have to gauge fix the action. So as was discussed later here, you would have to add ghosts and a gauge fixing term. But I'm not doing it right now. But when you do perturbation theory in Jack Mills, it's crucial to take into account the ghosts and the gauge fixing term. And I think next week you will be using that when computing the spectrum of dimensions of operators in this theory. The statement that this Lagrangian is supersymmetric is the statement that it's invariant under the following continuous transformation. So I vary the gauge field like that. Lambda is the, it's sometimes called the gaugino. Epsilon is the variation parameter. But since this is a fermionic symmetry, instead of being Grassmann even, it's Grassmann odd. It's like a fermion, okay? But the continuous parameter. What's the normalization? Okay, if I want to be really careful, I should. So this gamma MN is nothing but the commutator, one half the commutator of two gamma matrices. I understand that you had exercises about gamma matrices, so I'm not going to really spend time over this. But times epsilon plus gamma. Okay, let me do it. I started, let me finish. So gamma M I d mu phi I minus actually I gamma I j, the commutator of phi I phi j acting on epsilon. So if you do the variation of this action with respect to this transformation, you'll see that it's invariant. And that's a statement that the theory is supersymmetric. Since it is a continuous symmetry, it means that associated to these transformations, there is a conserved current, which is, in fact, is a supercurrent. That's the usual terminology. And therefore, it means that if you have a conformal field theory that is also supersymmetric, you should add to your superconformal generators that we were discussing earlier in the lecture the associated conserved supercurrent. That if you really want to know what it is, let me not write it down. The way you would derive it is you plug in this into the, you do the Noether method. You plug in the transformations into here, and you look at the total derivatives, and that gives you the conserved current. Okay, just like you construct the conserved current associated to any symmetry in field theory. The only thing that's a bit different here is that the generators of the conserved of the symmetry are fermionic as opposed to bosonic. Okay, so that means that this particular theory. What are the symmetries of this theory? Let me erase this.
Can I just ask about gamma I? The gamma M is the fundamental gamma
M. No. So I was cheating a little bit. You should never do it, but it turns out that this theory. Okay, this would be a little bit of a detour. I don't know if I should do it, but essentially the reason what I'm doing is I'm representing these lambdas are 16 has 16 fermionic degrees of freedom. And in order to make the theory, maybe should I stop here or?
That's a good point.
No, maybe let me finish the answer. So this spinner has 16 fermionic degrees of freedom. And in 10 dimensions, the smallest spinner, the smallest dimension spinner you can have is exactly 16 dimensional. So essentially what I'm doing is I'm writing the theory, even though lambda, so the spinner index of lambda is a 10 dimensional spinner index. So it has 16 components, even though it only depends on four space-time coordinates. Okay? So that means that this index is acted on, instead of by the usual four-dimensional Gamma matrices, they're acted on by the 10-dimensional Gamma matrices. So this Gamma M has a spinner indices alpha and beta. So all these multiplications, what I've done here essentially is split M that goes from 1 to 10 into M that goes from 1 to 4, which are the four dimensions where the field theory lives, and an index I, which is kind of an internal symmetry. It goes from 5 to 10, or from 1 to 6, which also rotates the 6 scalars. So essentially what I've done is a very elegant repackaging of combinations of four-dimensional fermions. I've written it in a unified way by writing things in terms of a unique 10-dimensional spinner. So all these gamma matrices are just, for example, here, are nothing but the 10-dimensional gamma matrices. Okay. So maybe tomorrow, if this was not completely clear, we can go over it again. And tomorrow we will definitely discuss the holographic dual of these four-dimensional equals four Young Mills and how to use the ADS-C3 correspondence to study observables on both sides of the correspondence.
So we'll start in 7 minutes.